This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. government is now spending $1.5 billion a week on the war in Iraq. That's $200 million plus a day. And nobody is quite sure where all that money is going. Government audits have found at least $20 billion unaccounted for. And everyone knows a big, ugly chunk has gone to fraud, corruption, and war profiteering. Projects claimed but not built. Huge overcharges. Mountains of money just missing. Bundles of cash shipped home by soldiers' duffel bag. With billions in U.S. dollars literally being flown around in the night by helicopter by the ton on pallets. Anything can happen, and a lot has. Up next on Point, reconstruction and corruption in the Iraq War. Joining me now from Washington is T. Christian Miller, who has been reporting on Iraq reconstruction for the Los Angeles Times. He is at work on the forthcoming book, Blood Money, A Story of Wasted Billions, Lost Lives, and Corporate Greed in Iraq. T. Christian Miller, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
There's a lot that we want to learn today. We want to get into the details of what's known and what is not known but suspected about corruption in Iraq. But tell us the story of Colonel Westhusing first, if you would.
Colonel Ted Westhusing was a professor at West Point. He taught English and philosophy, and he had written extensively on questions about military honor and ethics. In fact, his dissertation was on the nature of honor and what it means to be an honorable soldier. While he was at West Point, he decided that he should volunteer to go to Iraq, in part to be able to better teach his students. As in many cases in Iraq, the actual training of the Iraqis has been turned over to a private company called USIS. It's a large and well-known security company based in Virginia. And his job is to supervise them and what they do. By all accounts, at first, he's quite competent, in fact, more than competent at what he does, and earns high praise from his commanding officers. But in May, he gets a letter, an anonymous whistleblower letter, that troubles him greatly. The letter basically accuses the company, USIS, of both some contractual fraud-type allegations, such as they hadn't supplied enough trainers to adequately train the Iraqis. It also has more serious allegations. The letter writer, the anonymous letter writer, says that USIS employees had witnessed a murder and not reported it, and in another case had actually taken part in offensive operations in the siege of Fallujah. So these allegations troubled Colonel Westhusing greatly, and his emails home begin to reflect his dissatisfaction with the process in Iraq. And his conversations with his colleagues, he begins talking about that he didn't come to Iraq to have to deal with greedy contractors, was the phrase that he used. And then he reports these allegations and they begin to be investigated. And in the middle of that is when he is found dead in his trailer.
This is a trailer outside of Baghdad, one bullet from a 9mm pistol, an apparent suicide note. The Army determined, you report, that it was in his handwriting saying, "I cannot support a mission that leads to corruption, human rights abuse, and liars. I am sullied. I came to serve honorably and feel dishonored death before being dishonored anymore." Is it clear that it was suicide? If it was, suicide is always a complicated matter. How straight the line from this to an atmosphere of corruption in Iraq?
That's a great question. As far as I could tell in my reporting, I would say the bulk of the evidence would point to a suicide. But I would hasten to add that we don't have all the evidence in hand.
The family seems unconvinced, but from your
report. There are at least some family members, not all, but some, who are troubled by holes, what they see as holes in the military's investigation. And it wouldn't be the first time that the military hadn't thoroughly investigated a death or a suicide. And so they're troubled by, for instance, the actual place where he is found dead is the camp where USIS, the contractor that he is accused of wrongdoing, conducts their operations. He is... there's a 15-minute gap that they feel is an unexplained period of time when it's not clear when his body is found and when he's first discovered missing. So they have some questions, and they want the military to conduct a thorough investigation, more thorough investigation, as well as they want an independent investigation into the issue. And there are such things ongoing.
I guess the backdrop here to begin with is the huge scale of the money. You describe tons and tons of cash, $100 bills, being flown and dropped in various parts of Iraq.
Well, yes, you know the saying, honey attracts flies. You had perhaps the biggest pot of honey since the Marshall Plan in 1945 or 1947, actually, the Rebuild Europe. It was just a lot of money in one place at one time and attracted a lot of people who were interested in making money.
Now, this interaction of private contractors and the military, it clearly gave Colonel Westhusing a lot of pause. At the end of the day, he didn't like it. And, of course, the allegation that he got was that the company he was working with was shorting the government on the number of trainers they put out there to increase their profit margins. He said this just isn't honorable. But what about the privatization of support services, security, retraining, reconstruction? Have structural problems with that emerged? Could it be done better by the military, or is that utterly impracticable?
Well, that depends. Those are all really good questions, high-level policy questions that I think are going to be taken apart by the Pentagon after this is all said and done. I think there is, in general, a lot of unease in the military that we've gone too far and that there are too many contractors doing too many things that were once done by the military. There is a perennial issue of using contractors, which the military has used for centuries, is that once you get out on a battlefield, if the bullets start flying, you as the commander can't order a private company to do anything, and that private company can leave the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And that would leave a hole, obviously, in your defensive or offensive capabilities.
And to this point, with so much of Iraq as a battlefield, that means lots of places where reconstruction can't or hasn't taken place because of security issues.
Right, exactly right. And so the question then is, well, all right, if we've gone too far, what is the proper balance? Because do you really want the military to be building power plants and power stations? And do you really want the military to be digging brand new water canals through central Iraq, an area which is obviously not their specialty, would cost a lot of money, would take away from their primary mission, which is, frankly, going out and killing people? Mm. So there is a balance to be struck. And there is no question, at least in my mind, that there is a use and a need for private contractors. But I would say, on the basis of my reporting and the feedback I get, that there is a lot of discomfort at this level in the military, in the government, in Iraq, with how many functions have been turned over to the private contractors.
Ian is calling from Laurel, Maryland. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to know a couple things. One, how much of the corruption is spent as cost of business, simply dealing with the Iraqi nationals? And two, how does the cost of corruption as your guest sees it compare to the cost of legitimate rebuilding? So we build something once, it gets destroyed, and we have to rebuild it again, which in my mind seems in the same sort of category of money flushed down the drain.
Ian, let me ask you about, is that a euphemism, cost of business? Are you saying Iraqi corruption? You're looking at sort of laying it off on Iraqis, doing business with Iraqis?
I'm sure that there's some percentage that is necessary to get the wheels moving smoothly, as it were, yes.
Sort of a cultural thing. Let us pick that up, Ian. Thanks for the call. Ian's kind of suggesting that maybe this is just Americans having to deal with local custom. Is that how you see it?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. There's two broad pots of money here. One is Iraqi money, which is money that they gain from selling off oil. And then there's U.S. taxpayer money. With the Iraqi money, the U.S. has been notably less concerned with how that money gets spent and with accounting for it. And when you talk about the billions that have been gone missing or been accounted for, almost always that's Iraqi money because the same contracting rules didn't apply quite deliberately so. And it's, of course, outrageous that that money was put into our care and we really didn't care for it as we would have our own.
So when you say it's Iraqi money, that doesn't necessarily mean, though, that its missingness is the Iraqis' fault. A lot of this was Iraqi money in American hands.
Yeah, that we spent and we were supposed to be the caretakers of under international law and UN resolution as well, and we simply weren't. The second set of money is U.S. taxpayer money, which has been spent much more slowly and much more carefully. But I think what your caller is talking about is essentially how much money actually ends up on the ground. And that's a question which I've wrestled with and which the many other think tanks have wrestled with and the Inspector General has wrestled with. And I'll give you my own sense of it, is that you have about of every dollar, U.S. dollar we're talking about here. I'm not talking about sort of money corruption. We're just talking about how much money ends up on the ground. About 25% is going to go paid for security costs. These are things like security guards and insurance for, against killings. Another 10% is going to be corporate profit because they have a guaranteed 3% profit and then they can get a certain percentage above that. And I think it's been averaging out at around 10%.
Cost plus.
So now you're at 35% of your dollars not arriving on the ground in Iraq. You have, I think, like an industry standard is 5 to 10%, just for kind of like loss and things breaking and slippage, they call it. So now you're at 45%, and then you have a variety of other costs that are insurance costs, and a lot of these contracts are subcontracted, so each subcontractor takes 10%. And so I have sort of, this is just my gut sense, believe that you're only seeing about a half to 40 cents of every dollar actually arriving on the ground in Iraq.
And that's an accounting without a corruption margin built in.
Right. That's no corruption. I'm saying that's just how, if everything goes according to plan, I wouldn't expect to see, in a lot of cases, not every case, but in a lot of the projects where there are high security costs and there are high profit margins, that you just aren't going to see more than about a quarter, 50 cents of every dollar ending up on the ground.
We're joined now from Austin, Texas, by Tom Palaima. He's a professor of classics at the University of Texas in Austin. He's written extensively about war and violence. He was a friend and mentor of Colonel Ted Westhusing, and he's written since Colonel Westhusing's death about that death and its meaning. Tom Palaima, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Tom.
It must have been painful for you to read the note left behind, "I came to serve honorably and feel dishonored." Fill in the picture of who Ted Westhusing was for us, Tom Palaima, and how you interpret this death.
I think it would be very easy in this case to view his story as very similar to Sophocles' Ajax, you know, a noble warrior whose high sense of ethics and morality couldn't cope with the surrounding, you know, ambiguities, moral ambiguities of war. One of the things, while we're talking about, you know, contractor corruption, let's not forget that, you know, Ted was charged with being senior advisor to the civilian police assistant training team and so forth. And one of the things that really concerned him, he was frustrated not just with financial corruption, but what he said was lying and killing by contractors and also by Iraqi police in cases where they were supposed to be protecting people. Ted was an extraordinary human being. He was a gifted and accomplished military officer. He was an intellectual with a long view of military ethics, going back into the period that I taught him in ancient Greece, and he came and learned at the in his late 30s in a summer intensive Greek program the Greek he needed to do his dissertation on this subject.
But when you see what happened near Baghdad with him ending up dead, do you see, as one of our callers said earlier, an officer who was wrapped too tight, or an Ajax who couldn't cope with the ambiguity, or an officer who honestly faced things that were not right and couldn't figure out how to make them right to the point that he killed himself?
The circumstances of Ted's death really fit the pattern that Jonathan Shea, who works with people who suffer post-traumatic stress, talk about, that namely what really causes difficulties for people of such high integrity, commitment to duty, high principles of morality, is what he calls betrayal of what is right. When the And the entire situation there is what people should be looking at rather than at Ted's particular circumstances. You have a situation where an elite-trained officer corps is dealing with not soldiers who have been brought within the military and gotten an enculturation into the principles that they should uphold as trained protectors of our liberties, but you're dealing with contract people. You're dealing with an Iraqi security force that many stories have admitted is infiltrated by insurgents, carrying out vendettas, and so on. And so it's the system of contracting out not just 50% of the Department of Defense budget for the Iraqi war, but contracting out the very tasks that trained military men with whom Ted was trained to work, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden he's dealing with people who are there purely for profit. They are there purely for profit. Even if they were formerly military men, they are not there to uphold the liberties of the United States, maybe so in a personal way, but they're putting themselves in harm's way purely for profit.
For profit, not for honor.
Yes, exactly. But what one needs to get at here is, again, Tim O'Brien talks about the nature of war and war stories. The most tragic thing about this, I would think, would be to concentrate on Ted's case and turn it into a personal tragedy that you can read T. Christian Miller's story over the breakfast table and then say how sad it is that a man of such honor could not face up to the moral ambiguities of war. I don't think that that's the lesson here that one should extract.
Indeed, we're trying to look at just that bigger context.
Yes, exactly.
In this hour.
But it needs to be looked at not just from the point of view of financial malfeasance and the corruption with contractors, but also needs to be looked at from the point of view of how do you what kind of situation are you putting an officer in? What caused somebody like Ted Westhuizing, so accomplished, so brilliant, so talented, so high-achieving, even within an elite officer corps, to feel so isolated and so frustrated. One of the other things I'd like to point out is when soldiers feel the stress of war, it's a commonplace all the way from the Iliad through every war of the 20th century and now into the Iraqi war, that what they end up fighting for when they can't believe in anything else is their band of brothers, their fellow soldiers. Now, what happens when you put an officer in a situation where he has no fellow soldiers, where there are no trained fellow soldiers that he's really dealing with, and what he's dealing with are contract troops or Iraqi security forces that have been infiltrated by the insurgency? This is just a terrible outcome of the general downsizing of government, but certainly the outsourcing of military tasks. I can't think of anything that's, in fact, more morally reprehensible.
T. Christian Miller.
As I said, it transcends Ted's story. Ted may be a kind of an exemplum, but it transcends it.
We hear that loud and clear. T. Christian Miller, you summarize Ted Westhuizing's question, how is honor possible in a war like the one in Iraq? It was a question for him. It's a question for the country at this point. President Bush says it is honorable when we achieve the final goal.
Yeah, I appreciate a lot of what Tom is speaking about, and I'm interested to hear his thoughts on Ted and Colonel Westhuizing. One of the things that I came to think about when I was dealing with these issues, the larger issues that Tom is speaking about, is if you're a military officer, you are trained from the time you enter the military until you reach your highest rank that you deal with soldiers. And when you give a soldier an order to jump, the soldier is supposed to ask how high. Now you put somebody like Colonel Westhuizing into a situation where you have contractors and you give them an order to jump and they ask how much. There is no relationship between that's a fracture of the whole way the military is supposed to work. instead of following orders and doing what you're supposed to be doing because it's the right thing to do, you have a company which will, or a people which work because they're going to make some money. And that's just a completely different situation.
And right there we have the story of a man, maybe a metaphor, maybe a mess. T. Christian Miller with the Los Angeles Times, we thank you for your reporting. We thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Tom Palaima, former professor of Ted West Husing at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor Palaima, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.